and ask the question, the tough question, how can you believe a Bible that is full of contradictions? And it is truly amazing how often this question is asked. Yes?
My favorite one is when they say, he fed 4,000, but he fed 5,000. See, you can't trust him.
That's right. The one I like was, fellow said, well, the silliest thing about the Bible is that the ark was supposed to be so big you carry all those animals. And then it says that the priest picked up the ark and carried it across the Jordan. Yeah, okay. This question contains an assumption that the Bible is filled with many discrepancies, which, if true, would make it impossible to believe that the Bible has a divine origin. It is a popular idea to maintain. It's generally accepted, I would say, in academia at least, to maintain that the Bible disagrees with itself, which casts considerable doubt on its trustworthiness. So this is something that you will find, and it's like they want to tell you, well, you know, I don't want to discourage you or anything, but the Bible is full of discrepancies, contradictions. It's an important thing for us to get into tonight. Well, the soft answer, rather than, oh yeah, we want to deal with them in a soft answer. We do not argue with the conclusion that they're coming to, that if indeed the Bible contains actual demonstrable error, it would, in fact, show at least those parts could not have come from a perfect, all-knowing God. We would agree with that, see. We do disagree, however, with the beginning premise that the Scriptures are full of mistakes. Of course, it's very easy to accuse the Bible of inaccuracies. That's fairly simple. But it is quite another matter to prove it. And while we don't want to just stick our chin out and say, oh yeah, prove it, you know, what we're trying to say is, if you are right, then we would have to agree with you. But we don't believe you're right. We believe you're wrong at the very outset. So the explanation then. Certain passages may, at first glance, appear to be contradictory, but investigation shows that it is not the case. So what we're asking, first of all, is fairness. One of the things for which we appeal with regard to possible contradictions is fairness. What do I mean by that? Well, the critic must not exaggerate the problem and must begin by giving the author the benefit of a doubt. Why? Because this is the rule in other literature. When we ask that it also be the rule here. Very often, however, the Bible is different from everything else. It has to prove, you have to stand on your head to prove things that are just accepted elsewhere. So they want a different set of rules when it comes to examining the Bible. And to this, we immediately and adamantly object. So let's look at some definitions. What constitutes a contradiction? Well, we get back to logic. The law of contradiction, which is the basis of all logical thinking, states that a thing cannot be both A and non-A at the same time. In other words, it can't be both raining and not raining at the same time. Now, if one can demonstrate a violation of this principle from Scripture, then and only then can he prove a contradiction. For example, if the Bible said, which it does not, that Jesus died by crucifixion both at Jerusalem and at Nazareth at the same time, this would be a provable error. Nobody even claims that, but that would be one, you see. So let's look then at resolutions. How do we resolve this? Well, remember that two statements may differ from each other without being contradictory. Now, some fail to make a distinction between contradiction and mere difference. For instance, one of the things that they point out is the case of the blind men at Jericho that Christ healed. Matthew relates how two blind men met Jesus, while both Mark and Luke mention only one, in fact, naming him as Bartimaeus. However, neither of these statements denies the other. Therefore, we consider them complementary in the sense they complement, they fulfill each other. The idea would be, suppose you were talking to two friends, Abe and Bert, at a coffee shop where you ordered tea. Later, you tell Carl that you talked to Abe today. Maybe something came up about Abe. Yeah, I talked to him today. Then, an hour later, you see Dave, and you tell him that you talked to both Abe and Bert. Now, when Carl and Dave compare notes, it may seem to be a contradiction. Well, he only said he talked to Abe. But there would be no contradiction. Now, if you had told Carl that you talked only to Abe, you would have contradicted the statement by what you told Dave, you see. But that's not what you said. The statements you actually made are different, but not contradictory. So likewise, many biblical statements fall into this category. Let's give some examples then. Number one, some passages are not correctly read. It's been pointed out in Judges, we have the account of the death of Sisera. And in Judges 4, verse 21, it says, then Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent peg, and took, the Hebrew, and put an hammer in her hand, and went softly unto him, and smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. Don't you imagine? She nailed him. Okay, story there, he was fast asleep, very weary, and she drove the tent peg down through the temples into the ground. Judges 5 says this, he asked water, and she gave him milk. She brought forth butter in a lordly dish. She put her hand to the nail and her right hand to the workman's hammer, and with the hammer she smote, the Hebrew says she hammered, Sisera, and smote off his head when she had pierced and stricken through his temples. At or between her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay down. At or between her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell down dead, literally fell down destroyed. This is a poetic section that's singing the song of what she did. So the question comes up, wait a minute, was he asleep or was he drinking milk? See, it actually says he was drinking milk, and that's when she put her hand to the nail and the other hand to the workman's hammer. Well, actually, what we just read does not say that he was drinking milk at the moment of impact, which would have been pretty odd. You know, he's going like this and she's going... You're reading into this just because it happens to mention the drinking of milk and then the nailing of the nail through the temples. That's your interpretation. That's your reading into it. It does not demand that these two things be contradictory at all. So they're just incorrectly read or read too much into it. A second example is that some passages need research. Sometimes two passages appear to be contradictory because the translation, always a difficult thing to translate into another language, that translation is not understood accurately. Knowledge of the original languages of the Bible can immediately solve these difficulties. For both the Greek and the Hebrew, as all languages, have their peculiarities that make them difficult to render into English or in any other language. So here's an example. Paul's conversion recorded in the book of Acts, recorded several times, but we'll look at two of them. Acts 9:7, "And the men which journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice," this is the voice from heaven, "but seeing no man." Compare that to Acts 22, verse 9, "And they that were with me saw indeed the light from heaven and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me." The one verse says, hearing a voice. The other says, heard not the voice. Now, these statements seem contradictory, clearly. And both, when you do your elementary research into the Greek, both of them use the same Greek word for to hear. It's the word akouo. So we do a little more research. And W.F. Arndt, Arndt and Gingrich, one of the great Greek lexicons of the language, said this: "The construction of the verb to hear, akouo, is not the same in both accounts. In Acts 9:7, which says they were hearing a voice, it is used with the genitive. In Acts 22:9, where it says they heard not, it's used with the accusative. The construction with the genitive simply expresses that something is being heard or that certain sounds reach the ear. Nothing is indicated as to whether the person understands what he hears or not." You see? "The construction with the accusative, however, describes a hearing which includes mental apprehension of the message spoken. From this, it becomes evident that the two passages are not contradictory, but again, supplementary. We actually know more now than we knew before. Acts 22:9 does not deny that the associates of Paul heard certain sounds. It simply declares they did not hear in such a way as to understand. Sometimes words from God sound like thunder or other things to people. They didn't understand what was being said. Our English idiom in this case simply is not so expressive as the Greek. The Greek was just the hearing of the voice, and the voice is in the genitive or the voice is in the accusative. That was very clear to the Greek. So it must also be stressed that when a possible explanation is given to a Bible difficulty, it is then unreasonable for the critic to state that the passage contains an actual error. If a reasonable explanation is given, that's really all that's necessary. We don't have to convince this critic to eliminate this as a problem. Now, you can't be, just silly about your explanation. It has to be a logical explanation. The third example: some passages contradict only our present knowledge. There was a time when historians were laughing at the Old Testament that talked about the Hittites and the Hittites having a kingdom and so on. They said, "We, have studied all the archaeology, and there never were any Hittites." Just stop and think for a moment what people have learned from archaeology. What is the chance of finding out everything by archaeology? I mean, just stumbling on the thing. You can't go into the Middle East and say, "Excuse me, I want to dig up your city." People are living there. It's only when these things, and usually it's accidental. Now, they might have come to a certain spot and dug there, But what's the chance of a significant find there, a historical thing? It's just, you know, that they might uncover something that reveals something else. It's just a long shot. So to say, because all these long shots haven't turned up something about the Hittites, that was kind of a stupid concept. Because then, guess what happened? They found the Hittites. And they found evidence of it all over. They had actually found it before, they just didn't know it was the Hittites. Once it was identified, they said, well, man, that was a big kingdom. It was all over there. Yeah, just like what the Bible said. When we were going through Daniel some time back, I pointed out that Belshazzar was the listed as the ruler, and they said, "Well, we have the list of the kings, and it ends with his father." And so they found out then, with a little more research, that the father had turned it over to him as he hightailed it out of there because he didn't like the way things were shaping up. So it was Belshazzar that was there when Babylon fell. So they didn't know, but they said they acted like they did know. So some difficulties result from our lack of knowledge about the circumstances do not necessarily involve an error. These only prove that we are ignorant of the background. As historical and archaeological study proceed, new light is shed on difficult portions of Scripture. Many so-called errors have disappeared with the new information. Wisdom, then, allows a wait-and-see attitude on some problems. Well, we don't have any evidence of this. Well, so far you don't, you see. So what is our conclusion? Admittedly, all Bible difficulties and claimed discrepancies have not yet been cleared up. But it is our firm conviction that as more knowledge is gained of the Bible's past, these problems will fade away. They always have before. So the Bible describes God as an all-knowing, all-powerful being who cannot contradict himself. So his word, when properly understood, cannot contradict itself. I was reading about Robert Browning, the English poet. He was a good guy. He was a man of faith and held to it. Wrote a critique on Darwinism and so-called natural religions. He called it Caliban on Seta. What is it called? And Caliban, if you remember your Shakespeare, was the monster character in The Tempest, where the tempest caused a ship to crash, and when they got there, they found that it was a sorcerer who caused the tempest to cause them to crash. And we meet Caliban, who is a monster. He's a monstrous human type of character. And he was befriended at first, but then he tried to steal away the sorcerer's daughter. He wanted to populate the island with little Calibans. And so the sorcerer bewitched him and made him into a powerful servant, dim-witted as he was. In other words, Caliban becomes this brute, this animal-like human being that serves a purpose. And I thought it was pretty clever of Browning to talk about that, Darwinism makes us all then animals that just happen to be walking around like men. I brought him up for something. Oh, yes. It said in the description that during his period of time, the historical critique of the Bible became quite popular. And it says, how did he deal with that? He dismissed it as irrelevant. And that's kind of interesting because at this point today, all the historical criticism has been found to be irrelevant. A bunch of guys sitting around in their office coming up with these things, And then when they actually dug around and did some real research, they found that no, none of that's true. So it was just their unbelieving doubt that was the basis of the historical criticism of the Bible. So here's a man who by faith recognized that doesn't mean anything. These are people sitting around talking. You can say anything. It doesn't prove anything. And he was right. Psalm 119, 140. Thy word is very pure. The Hebrew here uses the word that means tried, refined, as we were singing. Therefore, thy servant loveth it. Faith in God, who wrote the Bible, gives us a faith in the Bible that just as it always has been proved true, that all of the so-called discrepancies have fallen away, so it will always be. One of the things I've said to people, I said, well, I hear that a lot about the discrepancies. I've been studying for quite a while. I've never really found one. Maybe you could help me out and share that with me. I mean, for the most part, they never looked. They just heard it, and that was enough. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've done the same. I was taking part in a discussion. Someone said there were a lot of discrepancies. I said, could you give me some contradictions? And he said, well, I don't know off the top of my head. I said, well, feel free to look them up. I said, I'll wait. And he never was able to bring any forth that could not be explained.
Yeah.
You know, some of it, like you said, is silliness. You know, the idea that because in one account it doesn't give all the information, that means that the other account that has additional information is suddenly wrong. An example of this in my own life happened today. I was talking to Charles, and I referred to Amber as his sister. Mm-hmm. Selena got very upset and said, she's our sister. Why did you call her his sister? And I said, She is his sister. And she is all of your sister. I said that it doesn't, the two don't exclude each other.
Exactly.
One thing where people will make claims that it's because of an anachronistic looking at things, you know, thinking that people have always meant the same thing by what they say. Something as simple as how do you reckon the passage of time? Do you count, if you say, here's an example where we don't even think about it. If I said in 3 days something's going to happen, a Westerner says, well, today's Wednesday, so it'll be Thursday, Friday, it'll happen on Saturday. An Easterner doesn't think that way. If I say something's going to happen in 3 days, that means Friday. You count today. It's called inclusive reckoning versus exclusive reckoning. Mm-hmm. There's a great book called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings in which he deals with that, where people have accused the Bible of contradictions in the reigns of the kings of Israel and Judah, that when you add them up, they don't add up right.
Yeah.
And he argues very simply, he says, this isn't a contradiction. They didn't follow exclusive reckoning.
Thiele, wrote that and just did such a marvelous work. His work is accepted by everybody now.
Spanish count, exclusively so, but you know where we say every other day?
Mm-hmm.
They say every third day.
Every third day.
Same thing.
Yeah. Thiel points out that everybody had just given up because the numbers didn't match. And he said, well, you have very clearly at a certain point, you have where the first year of the king was counted from the first day that, you know, like we say, January to December. So if he began ruling in December, this year counted his first year.
Right.
And others would say, well, it wouldn't begin until the next year began, even if he started in February, wouldn't be until the next year. So with that, just that much of an understanding, he solved it all. And it just took somebody reverently looking at it and coming up with the answer to undo all the so-called contradictions. It's good. Any other comments or questions?